This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Nice Girls Don't Date Dead Men. Written by Molly Harper and narrated by Amanda Ronconi.
Chapter 1. With foot and paw planted in the human and animal worlds, where creatures mix techniques from both cultures to secure relationships. This can lead to lifelong happiness or a very confused potential mate. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. I can't do this, Jane. It's just wrong, I whimpered. It defies the laws of nature, the thin line that separates good and evil. Zeb rolled his eyes and snapped the bridal binder shut. It's just a dress, Jane. It's a puce dress, Zeb. Jolene's getting it in peach, he grunted, clearly at his limit in dealing with whiny, undead bridal party members. Why are you being so difficult? Why is your fiancé insisting that I dress like Naomi from Mama's Family? It's not that bad, Zeb insisted. Not that bad? I opened the binder and pinned the offending picture with my finger. The model's defiantly blank expression could not mask her embarrassment at wearing this sateen nightmare. It was off the shoulder, with a wide ruffle of retina-burning color that gathered at the cleavage with a fabric cabbage rose. The traditional butt bow actually connected to what can only be described as a waist lapel. Despite not having that many girlfriends, I had been a bridesmaid 3 times in 10 years. Apparently, I was tall enough to match the rest of the bridal party for Marcy, my college roommate from freshman year. My sophomore roommate, Carrie, had a cousin who had the nerve to get pregnant, and I just happened to fit the cousin's abandoned bridesmaid dress. I'm pretty sure my junior roommate, Lindsay, only asked me because she wanted plain bridesmaids. She said something about not wanting to be outshone on her big day. I was thankful to get a private room my senior year. My sister, Jenny, never even considered making me a bridesmaid. Ironically, her reason for not asking me, not liking me, resulted in this inadvertent and certainly unintentional kindness. I'd suffered butt bows. I'd carried those stupid matching shawls that never stayed on past the ceremony. I'd worn mint sorbet, periwinkle fizz, and passionate pomegranate, all of which translated into hideous $175 dress with shoes dyed to match, neither of which you will wear again. And now, Jolene McLean, the betrothed of my best friend, wanted me to wear the ugliest dress of them all. Jolene and Zeb had met at the local chapter of the Friends and Family of the Undead, where Zeb had sought help after my new undead condition left him even twitchier than usual. It was your basic love story. Boy meets girl, boy dates girl, girl turns out to be a werewolf, boy and girl get engaged, and slowly drive me insane. In a way, I brought the two of them together, which meant I had no one to blame for this hoop-skirted fiasco but myself. I knew the whole point of having bridesmaids was dressing them like circus folk so you would look better by comparison. But this was beyond the pale. I'd be lucky if angry villagers didn't pelt me with rotten produce. "This is why I wanted to go shopping with you," I cried, flopping back on the couch with the boneless petulance of a teenage orthodontia patient.
"Well, the bridal barn closes at about 3 hours before sunset, Jane. So unless you're willing to risk bursting into flame just to exercise your control issues over a stupid dress, I think we're out of options."
Humph. I hadn't been a vampire for very long, so sometimes I forgot about the limitations of my condition and the pain Zeb took to avoid throwing said limitations in my face. It didn't mean I was going to wear that monstrosity of a dress, but I would at least stop giving Zeb a hard time. I had developed a nasty habit of needling Zeb since he'd started planning his wedding. Zeb had been my best friend since, well, forever. I was used to having his undivided attention. Of course, he was used to me breathing and eating solid foods. We'd both had to make adjustments. He was just much better at them. It seemed doubly cruel to pick on Zeb now. While some members of Jolene's family were thrilled that she was marrying a nice guy with a stable income and his own home, there were several uncles who declared the union clan shame.
the werewolf version of a Shonda. Werewolves are the most highly evolved were species. They have the most regular change cycle and the most complete, dependable changes. Being natural pack animals in both forms, they also have the most stable social hierarchy. There is an alpha male mated to the female of his choice, who becomes the alpha female. While the lesser clan members have property rights and general free will, all major decisions must be filtered through the alpha couple, particularly the alpha male. Everything from mate selection to business management has to be deemed for the good of the pack. Jolene's family was one of the first to settle in Half Moon Hollow. Their farm was now home to the clan alpha couple, Lonnie and Mimi McLean, their three children, 18 aunts and uncles, and 49 cousins. Jolene was the last unmarried female in her generation, which is not to say she had been without proposals. She'd been courted by scions of several prominent werewolf clans. Her own cousin Vance, a tall fellow who reminded me of Jethro from the Beverly Hillbillies, only more broody, had made several failed bids for her paw since she'd turned 17. But it was my gangly, goofy, incurably human BFF who stole her heart away. Lonnie had to tamp down Vance's open griping about Jolene's engagement with a visit to Vance's trailer. It was the werewolf equivalent of a trip to the woodshed. Vance responded by driving to Jeb's house and peeing in his yard. Apparently you have to be male or a wolf to understand what an insult this was. In a werewolf pack, you cannot interfere with the mate choice of a clan fellow. You cannot intentionally harm that werewolf's chosen mate. You are not, however, required to help that person should he find himself in a life-threatening situation. Somehow, Zeb had managed to stumble into several such situations in the few months since he'd been engaged to Jolene. He'd had several hunting accidents while visiting the McLean farm, even though he didn't hunt. The brakes on his car had failed while he was driving home from the farm. Twice. Also, a running chainsaw mysteriously fell on him from a hayloft. He would never get that pinky toe back. Jolene insisted that her relatives were just being playful. I insisted that Zeb not venture out to the McLean farm without a vampire escort, which certainly hadn't improved his stance with the future in-laws. Despite the grudging acceptance they offered Zeb, most of the clan was distrustful of vampires. Some, in fact, wore vampire fangs around their necks next to the gold-plated charms that spelled out their names. On the other side of the aisle were Zeb's parents, Ginger and Floyd, and they weren't exactly thrilled about the wedding either. Mama Ginger had been planning my wedding to her son since we were kids. Apparently, the image of Zeb coming home to my pretend kitchen carrying a briefcase made of newspaper was permanently burned into her cortex. She figured that having known me since I was six and seen multiple examples of my being firmly planted under my own mama's thumb, I was the only acceptable candidate for a potential daughter-in-law. For my last living Christmas, she'd given me a Precious Moments wedding planner with my and Zeb's names already filled in. Mama Ginger saw the world as it should be, according to Mama Ginger. And when something didn't conform to that vision, she went to drastic lengths to correct it. I didn't know what made her think she had the right. It may have had something to do with all the chemicals she inhaled at her not-quite-licensed kitchen beauty shop. Just to give you an example, Mama Ginger could not fathom that I would go to senior prom with anyone but Zeb. So, she told several of the mothers at her salon that I was being treated for a suspicious rash. This fixed it so no boy at our high school would go anywhere near me with a corsage. With no other 11th-hour options, Zeb and I ended up going together. Mama Ginger kept the pictures in a place of honor on her mantle. As Mama Ginger couldn't have her say in choosing the bride, she decided to make planning the wedding as unpleasant as possible. She'd objected to the wedding date, saying it conflicted with her bingo night. Every plan Jolene had was dismissed as alternately trashy or too highfalutin. Mama Ginger was also incredibly insulted when Jolene politely refused the Precious Moments bride and groom cake topper she'd saved for Zeb's wedding. Precious Moments. Gah. I could rip a man's spinal column out through his nose, and I still found those things frightening. Zeb's father, Floyd, had expressed little interest in the wedding after he found out there wouldn't be a Velveeta fountain or a big screen showing the scheduled UK basketball game.
So, the reception was going to be fun. As much fun as one could have while dressed as Satan's tea cozy. The Naomi Harper bridesmaids' dresses were a concession to the McLean family tradition of renting formal wear from Jolene's Aunt Vonnie's dress shop, the Bridal Barn. Vonnie made all of the dresses herself, using three patterns, all of which ended up looking like a circa 1982 pattern called Ruffles and Dreams.
"I know, Janie. I know it's ugly," Zeb said, his big doe eyes all guileless and earnest.
"Dang it. I always buckled under those baby browns.
It's the world's ugliest dress. Of all the dresses you will ever wear, this is the one your body may reject like a faulty organ. As soon as I get back from the honeymoon, I will help you build the bonfire to burn this dress. But I'm asking you, as my closest friend in the entire world, will you please just wear the stupid dress for one day? Without whining, or describing it, or making Jolene feel bad, or pissing off Jolene's cousins.
Any more conditions? I grumbled. I reserve the right to make addendums, he said, one sandy blonde brow arching its way up to curly hair of the same shade.
What kind of kindergarten teacher talks like that? I groused.
Engagement had changed Zeb. He was more aggressive, more mature, partly from having to defend himself in life-threatening situations. Unfortunately, he was being more aggressive and mature with me, which sucked.
What kind of children's librarian takes a job at an occult bookstore? He countered.
Vampire, I pointed to my chest. And I'm not a librarian anymore. When they fire you, they kind of take the label, too. Zeb's smile thinned as he blinked owlishly and pressed his fingers to his temples. He took a pill bottle out of his pocket. You okay?
Yeah, he sighed. I've just been getting these headaches lately.
My pessimistic brain flashed on possibilities including clots and tumors. Batting down small flares of panic, I asked, Have you seen a doctor?
Yeah, he said they're probably stress-related.
I poked a finger at the wedding binder. I can't imagine.
Wedding planning is stressful, even when you're not marrying into a family with mouths full of fangs and guts full of burning hatred, both of which are aimed at you,
Zeb muttered as he dry-swallowed two Tylenol.
On a brighter note, where's your ghostly roommate?
Out, I said, of my great-aunt Jetty, who had died about 6 months before I was turned and had been pleasantly haunting me ever since. With my grandpa Fred again, they're becoming quite the hot and heavy couple.
I didn't realize ghosts roamed around so much, he said. Where do they go?
As long as it keeps me from seeing two deceased old people getting all touchy on my couch, I do not care.
He grinned. That's so gross.
Tell me about it, I grimaced. I'm working extra shifts at the bookstore unpaid just to get out of the house. I keep walking into rooms and finding them... Gah! And speaking of the store, we need to table the dress negotiations for now. My shift starts in about an hour. We're expecting some ancient Babylonian scrolls that Mr. Wainwright found on eBay, so he's really excited. He thinks they may have been used in a summoning rite.
So you purchased ancient Babylonian texts which may or may not call forth Gozer the Destroyer on eBay?
Zeb asked. He cocked his head and gave a goofy grin.
You know, a year ago, I would have thought you were kidding.
I shrugged, pushing the dreaded bridesmaid dress photo from my considerable field of vision.
And yet...
I scooped up the ringing phone, knowing before I pressed it to my ear that it would be my mother. I didn't use my spiffy new mind-reading powers or anything. Mama called every night before my shift to make sure I was careful on the 3-step walk from my car to the bookstore. She tended to forget that I now had super strength and could twist any prospective mugger into a pretzel. Mama had responded to my coming out as a vampire with the traditional stages of grief. She just got stuck at denial. She had decided to ignore it completely and pretend it away. She brought two frozen pot pies over to my house each week to help me out with my meals, which was handy because I needed something around to feed the ever-ravenous Jolene. Mama dropped by during the day, then got upset when the vampire sleepy time instinct kept me from chatting. It was as if she thought I could change my mind about being a vampire and give back my membership card.
I have some bad news, honey, Mama said as I picked up the phone. She'd long since parted with the niceties of phone greetings. After a dramatic pause, she said, "Grandpa Bob passed last night." "Aw," I moaned. "Another one?" This may seem like a strange, even cold, reaction, but you have to understand my Grandma Ruthie's marital history. She'd been widowed 4 times, via milk truck, anaphylactic shock, spider bite, and lightning strike, the lamented aforementioned Grandpa Fred. I wrote a poem titled "Grandpa's in an Urn" in 5th grade. I had to spend a lot of time in the guidance counselor's office after that. I loved Bob. Despite not being my actual grandpa or even a step-grandpa yet, Bob had always been nice to me. But he was engaged to Grandma Ruthie for 5 years and had chronic conditions of the heart, lungs, and liver. He had survived longer than expected. "Your grandmother says there was some sort of mix-up with his medication." Mama sighed. I could practically hear the cap from her nerve pills rattling loose. Knowing this would take a while, Zeb got out my blender to begin another batch of experimental Jane shakes. He'd been using a combination of condiments and dessert toppings to make the synthetic blood a little more like the human food I miss so much. My current favorite was Faux Type O, mixed with a little bit of cherry syrup and a lot of Hershey's new blood additive chocolate syrup. The pleasant sensation of chocolate without the unpleasant undead side effects. That was an excellent selling point, considering those side effects were the vomiting and agony that came with vampires trying to digest solid foods. Mama's voice trembled under the weight of Grandma Ruthie's expectations. "I don't know what I'm going to do. Grandma seems to think we should be hosting the funeral as the next of kin. Bob's children are having a fit. She's already made a scene down at Whitlow's funeral home over the release of the body. And now she expects me to help her plan the visitation, the buffet, the service." "The full Ruthie Early Lang Bodine Floss Whitaker special?" I asked. "I wish you would stop calling it that," Mama huffed. "She's had the same funeral service for 4 husbands. I'll call it what I want," I snorted. "Jane, I'm really going to need your help with this," Mama said, the faintest wheedling tone creeping into her voice. "Why can't Jenny help you with this?" "Jenny's busy with the Charity League Follies, and she's serving as chairwoman of the Women's Club Winter Ball this year." Mama was in full-blown whine now. "But good old Jane doesn't have a life, right? Why not make her chairwoman of the funeral luncheon?"
"Don't start that, Jane," Mama warned. "If you would just talk to Jenny and work out this silly business, you could both help me."
"I think it ceased being silly business when I was deposed," I told her. Jenny had made good on her promise not to talk to me after I came out to my family. She had, however, sent me a lovely note through the law firm of Hapscom and Schmidt, stating that Jenny wanted access to the family Bible. The Bible, which contained all of the early genealogical information, had been willed to me through our great Aunt Jetty as part of the contents of our ancestral home, River Oaks. Jenny's lawyers had stated that as a vampire, I could not touch it and had no use for it. I'd had the local offices of the ACLU and the World Council for the Equal Treatment of the Undead send her a cease and desist letter stating that such statements were inflammatory and untrue. She'd responded by sending me a copy of the family tree she'd painstakingly calligraphed onto parchment, with my name burnt out with a soldering iron. An ugly flurry of legal correspondence followed, and I ended up drinking Thanksgiving dinner with my parents after the rest of my family went home.
"Now, don't expect me to take sides," Mama said. "You girls are going to have to work this out for yourselves."
"Most of the funeral stuff is going to be done during daylight hours," I said. "I'm not even going to be able to attend the burial. Humans get upset when vampires burst into flames right next to them."
"But you have all the time in the world to plan Zeb's wedding," Mama grumbled.
She always got a little cranky when I brought up the V word.
"Where's the happy couple registered? The dollar store?"
"First of all..." "That was really funny," I whispered, glad that Zeb had ducked into the walk-in pantry and hadn't heard it. "But it was a mean thing to say. I'm the only one allowed to make mean jokes about Jolene's family, as I am the one wearing the ugliest dress in the history of bridesmaid kind."
"What color is it?" Mama demanded. "It's not yellow, is it? Because you know yellow makes you look sallow."
Mama, focus, please. I will help with the prep work for Bob's funeral as much as I can during the evening when I can fit it in around work hours, but I can't do much.
That's all I'm asking for, honey. A little effort, she said, placated.
As little as possible, I assured her. How's Grandma doing? I asked, trying not to let the resentment in my voice bubble through the phone line. Should I stop by her house on the way to work?
No, Mama said in a sad attempt to be vague. There's going to be such a crowd there.
And it would be a shame for me to come by and make things awkward, I finished for her. The heavy silence on Mama's end said I was right, but Mama preferred not to put it into words. I don't know why Grandma's rejection of me still stung. Elderly relatives were supposed to give you lipsticky kisses and ask intrusive questions about your love life. They were supposed to brag about your achievements to the point where non-relatives wanted to gouge their eardrums at the mere mention of your name. They were not supposed to require at least 1 week's advance notice if you attended family gatherings, or insist on wearing a cross the size of a hubcap whenever you walked into a room. My only consolation was that Grandma looked like Flavor Flav and usually tipped over under the weight of her bling. Eager to get back to a subject she could control, Mama listed the dishes she expected me to prepare to perk up the usual funeral potluck offerings. Apparently, there was some sort of dessert involving jello, cream cheese, and mandarin oranges in my future. While I saw it as completely unfair that someone who didn't eat should have to cook, these arguments failed to impress Mama. I promised to come by for my assigned shopping list after dark.
How are things going with that Gabriel? Mama asked.
Mama was happy I was dating someone, particularly someone who literally came from one of the oldest families in town, but she was pretending that Gabriel wasn't either. I could only expect so much.
Have you seen him lately?
Not for a week or so. He had to go to Nashville for business. On the other end of the line, Mama sighed. Dang it. I had just extended the conversation by about 20 minutes. Ever since I'd established a semi-sort of relationship with Gabriel, Mama's favorite activity had been giving me relationship advice. I thought she saw it as a girly bonding thing.
Honey, what have I always told you?
Now, honestly, that could be any number of things, ranging from avoid contact with any surface in a public bathroom to men don't buy the cow when you hand them the keys to the dairy. So I took a shot in the dark. Never trust a man with two first names, I guessed.
Well, yes, but not what I had in mind.
Never trust a man with a remote control fireplace, I suggested.
No,
she said, her patience audibly thinning. Never trust a...
Honey.
I could almost hear Mama shaking her head in dismay at my lack of man savvy.
Relationships are 50-50, give and take. You have to make an effort. He's up there all by himself for a whole week. Why couldn't you go up and visit him?
I have to work. And isn't that kind of desperate?
There's nothing wrong with showing some interest. You could make a little more of an effort. I could have Sheila take a look at your hair.
Mama, I really need to get off the phone if I'm going to make it to work on time, I said. And Zeb's over here and we're trying to talk about bridesmaid stuff. I've really got to go.
Don't let them put you in yellow. You know how washed out you look in yellow,
Mama was saying as I put the receiver in its cradle. Someone has to lock my grandma up. She's single-handedly taking down the greatest generation, I moaned. Zeb smirked at me as I slumped down and smacked my head against the counter. In a granite, muffled voice, I told him, Shut it, or I'm calling your mama and telling her that your parents' names aren't on the invitations. That'll keep you tied up for months.
That seems uncalled for, he muttered.
Chapter 2. From were-weasels to werewolves, weres are territorial creatures. Once a pack has established a home, they will not leave that location for generations until the local food sources have been depleted or they're burnt out by angry farmers. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. Half Moon Hollow is a strange place for a vampire to spend her days.
We don't have a performing arts center or a museum, but we have our own Rowdy Rural Towns episode of Cops. The program had never before featured the arrest of a naked guy stealing anhydrous ammonia. The Chamber of Commerce had a hard time fitting that into the brochure. Living in Kentucky is a mix of the ridiculous and the sublime. The same state that is home to top-shelf research hospitals, major manufacturers, and thoroughbred racing is a place where you can attend a school bus crash-up derby. They do take the kids off the buses before they race them. We have opera houses and Opry houses. We have cities that are home to hundreds of thousands and towns like the Hollow, where one day, if the right couple gets engaged, the entire population will be related by marriage. News of my transformation was slowly making the rounds of the Hollow kitchen circuit thanks to my former boss, Mrs. Stubblefield, using my application for undead employment benefits as justification for firing me from my position as the library's director of juvenile services. Of course, she fired me hours before I was turned, but that didn't keep her from crowing, "I told you so." She couldn't possibly let someone like that work around the public, much less as a children's librarian, she told anyone who would listen. Mrs. Woodley, whose five children I personally tutored in the library's Reading Remedy program, told her to shut her mouth or she'd toss Mrs. Stubblefield's lumpy butt out of the Half Moon Hollow Ladies' Garden Club. I sent Mrs. Woodley a dozen frozen pot pies as a thank you. Mrs. Stubblefield had recently retired, was asked to retire, after a band of roving teenagers, without my after-school tutoring program to keep them occupied, stuck pages from nudie magazines in all of the encyclopedias, and no one on the staff noticed. For a month. Plus, there was evidence that Mrs. Stubblefield shared her morning coffee with Jack Daniels. Mrs. Stubblefield's retirement meant that her stepdaughter, Posey, was the most senior member of the library staff. Posey, who was brought in to replace me, couldn't understand the Dewey Decimal System without sounds like clues, and laughed the way it was written out. Ha 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 ha. I hated her on principle, and that principle was bitterness. Through Mama, I heard about book club nights, trumped-up late fines, and items being checked out of the cannot possibly be replaced never to leave the library special collections room. Grant application deadlines had been missed, federal funding fell through for Puppet Time Theater and the Adult Literacy Program. Slowly but surely, my favorite library patrons were making their way over to the bad part of town to seek me out for their reading needs. It started when the Wednesday night book club president, Ann Woodhouse, stopped by to talk to me about a selection. Ann had lost faith in Mrs. Stubblefield's suggestion after she recommended that the club read the sequel to A Million Little Pieces. Then Sally Dortch stopped by to ask about Newbery Medal selections for Little Hannah's book report, but she saw Mr. Wainwright's display of fertility idols and bolted. To be fair, giant ceramic phalluses generally send me running for the nearest exit, too. Finally, Justine Markham and Kitty Newsom, the same library board members who helped Mrs. Stubblefield give me the boot, put on trench coats and Jackie O sunglasses to sneak into the shop and magnanimously announce that the board was willing to overlook my vampire status and welcome me back to the staff. I'm not going to say it wasn't tempting. It bothered me to see my library, a place that represented everything human and familiar to me, suffering. To see programs that had taken me years to cultivate crumbling. And I missed my kids. I missed their little faces, still and enraptured during story time. I missed helping each one find just the right book to help spark a love of reading, introducing them to the books that I loved as a kid. Roald Dahl, Louisa May Alcott, Anne M. Martin. I missed bringing teenagers back to reading after they finally got through that horrible, I'm too cool to like anything phase. But I had entered a new phase in my life, and as far as I was concerned, I could still do the kind of work I did at the library, at Specialty Books. I had done my best to keep in touch with the human world, be a respectable, undead citizen. Andrea Byrne, my new blood surrogate friend, was helping me find classes and other constructive activities to fill the night hours. We'd started taking yoga together. Sure, I didn't technically need breathing exercises anymore, but I was finally coordinated enough to balance on one foot. I had made a few friends there, several of whom switched to a different class after they realized I was a vampire. In further personal development, I'd started recycling everything in sight.
Since I was going to be walking the Earth a lot longer than originally forecast, I wanted it to last as long as possible. This, combined with the yoga, convinced my mother that I had joined a cult. I was one of the few vampires in the Hollow who chose to maintain relationships with the living after being turned. Studies showed that most vampires who had turned since tax consultant vampire Arnie Frink outed us with his right-to-work lawsuit dropped out of sight and moved to big cities such as New York or New Orleans. They became assimilated into the large populations of vampires and learned how to adjust to their new lifestyles. Or they became addicted to chemically enhanced blood, passed out in a gutter, and woke up as the rising sun fried them to a crisp. At least that's what Mama told me when I mentioned that I might go to St. Louis for a seminar called Emerging Issues for the Postmillennial Undead. Apparently Oprah did a whole show on vampires led astray. And somehow, I'd made it onto the undead junk mail radar. I started receiving advertisements for sans solar sun-blocking drapes and specialized vampire sleeping compartments, which were basically coffins. But at least I'd stopped getting credit card applications. After the government considers you dead, credit card companies are less likely to extend a credit line to you. It's the one discriminatory attitude toward vampires that's fine by me. But even the undead could appreciate the magical air in the Hollow as Christmas approached. The early December temperatures, always a crapshoot in western Kentucky, were hovering in the mid-40s. As a human, I'd been a summer person. But when getting a little color on your cheeks could leave you with third-degree burns and or permanent death, you learn to appreciate the joys of winter. The days were getting shorter, meaning that I could get up and around earlier. The cold brought a sharpness to the sense of the living, bright splashes of scent against a misty gray. The chill also gave me an excuse to wear the sleek new black coat I'd bought on a rather disastrous shopping trip with Andrea. She took me on a tour of these nice underground shops, not literally, on the outskirts of Memphis. And I didn't buy a damn thing but the coat. But at least I no longer looked like I was walking around in a big puffy sleeping bag. Christmas in the Hollow means spitting snow that never amounts to anything, but still sends everyone running for bread and milk. It means exchanging decorative tins of cookies with acquaintances you don't like that much. It's mall Santas who arrive in fire trucks, and challenging your neighborhood to a round of competitive outdoor decorating. Because you're not really celebrating the birth of Jesus unless your house can be spotted by passing aircraft. I stamped the whopping half inch of snow, mostly sleet and mud, from my boots as I neared the door of Specialty Books. The familiar smell of dust and crumbling paper greeted me as I called out to Mr. Wainwright. The shop was much cleaner than it had been that fateful night when I had wandered in and narrowly missed a shelf collapsing on top of me. Well, the mess was newer. We had at least lined up the bookshelves so that the customers could navigate without climbing. The soft hum of fluorescent lighting flickered over piles of browning paperbacks and splitting leather bindings. Gilt titles, rubbed away by loving fingers, glinted dully from their piles. I slid my shoulder bag behind the counter and surveyed the damage Mr. Wainwright had wrought since I had left 12 hours before. Trying to organize the shop was an uphill battle, and I was making no progress. It wasn't that Mr. Wainwright ignored my efforts, but when he looked for something, he had this way of tearing through like a tornado. We had a system. I spent 3 days painstakingly arranging a subject section. He destroyed it in less than an hour. It was like working for a slightly dangerous 3-year-old. I was, however, proud of the fact that there were no longer dead spiders occupying an entire shelf in the reference section. They were now occupying a jar in Mr. Wainwright's office. He's a nice man. I try not to ask questions. Our evening routine consisted of 2 hours of cleaning and boxing the online orders. Then, with no customers to speak of, he would make tea or warm bottled blood, and we would sit at the counter. He would tell me stories of his travels across the world seeking demon artifacts, vampire hoard houses, and packs of rare were creatures. He even spent 5 years in Manitoba searching for Sasquatch. "Hello? Mr. Wainwright?" I called again. I would never get to a point where I could call him by his first name. A person who knows that there was more than one Bronte sister deserves to be addressed with respect.
"Back here, Jane,"
came a muffled voice from the rear of the shop. I followed his voice to the stockroom, which we had only rediscovered the night before.
Mr. Wainwright had misplaced the door behind a rack of old Tales from the Crypt comics sometime in the mid-1980s. Mr. Wainwright? I saw two brown loafers sticking out from under a carton in a horrible parody of The Wizard of Oz. Mr. Wainwright's about 80 years old and looks as if you could snap him like kindling. His being pinned under a giant box of heavy books was not going to keep my paltry part-time employment checks coming in. "Are you all right?" I cried, lifting the box off him with little effort.
"Oh, thank you, Jane,"
he said, sitting up from his spot on the floor. He seemed to have made the best of his predicament. His ever-present lumpy gray cardigan was pillowed under his head. Clutched in one hand was an old dog-eared copy of Stephen King's Nightmares and Dreamscapes.
"Fortunately, when the box fell on me, this bounced off my head. I haven't read it in years. You must admire the universal accessibility of Mr. King. He scares the bejesus out of me every time."
"And he's the reason I have clown issues," I said, shuddering at the thought of it. "How long have you been down here?" He rolled his shoulders.
"Oh, 3 or 4 hours at the most."
"Are you hurt?" I asked.
"I'm tougher than I look,"
he said as I lifted him up and set him on a dusty folding chair. "I thought we agreed you weren't going to try to move things around without me here, after yesterday, when the other box fell on you," I said, struggling to keep a patient tone. I couldn't believe I was the practical one in this relationship.
"Well, yes, but I wasn't trying to move anything. I was searching for the light switch, you see, and knocked the shelving unit over. I remembered a book I left in here that I thought you might be interested in,"
he said. "You remembered a book you left in here 20 years ago?" I asked him. "What am I saying? Of course you did. Why don't you tell me where it is, and I'll get it for you?"
"Yes, I think that would be best," he said. "Top shelf, in the box marked Bell Witch."
I spider-climbed nimbly up the wall and plucked the box from the top shelf. Mr. Wainwright was grinning like a kid with a new comic book. He always got excited when I manifested my vampire powers. I unfolded the top of the carton and then thought better of it. "If I put my hand in this box, is there anything that will bite, sting, cut, burn, or turn me into dust?" This is one of the problems with working in an occult store. The previous week, I nearly lost a digit to a diary whose lock clapped a silver trap around keyless fingers. Vampires are allergic to silver. Touching it feels like a combination of burning, itching, and being forced to lick dry ice. If Mr. Wainwright hadn't come along with the suspicious little lock-busting gizmo he carries in his pocket, I wouldn't be able to make all those shadow puppets I like so much. Mr. Wainwright chewed on his lip.
"Just to be safe, I'll do the honors."
From the cobwebby, mouse-stained cardboard, Mr. Wainwright pulled a book titled The Spectrum of Vampirism.
"Here we are," he said, handing it to me. "I thought you might find this useful. It's very good, written by a Harvard fellow named Milton Winstead in the 1920s.
"Harvard?"
"Well, they can't all be law scholars and presidential candidates,"
Mr. Wainwright shrugged. "There are actual shades of vampirism?" I asked, reading over the table of contents and flipping to a chapter. "Vampires do not produce their own blood cells, which is why they must consume blood. The ingested blood is infused with the vampire's essence when metabolized, giving the vampire the ability to turn others. A vampire's power depends on the amount of vampire blood consumed during transformation. To make a child, a vampire will feed on a victim until he or she reaches the point of death. The sire must be careful not to leave the initiate unconscious or unable to consume the blood needed to complete the transformation, usually 2 or 3 pints. The process is literally draining for the sire, meaning that a vampire will create only 2 or 3 children in his or her considerable lifetime. The stronger and older a vampire is at the point of creating a child, the more likely that child is to be a healthy vampire. A quick or careless turning can result in a sickly vampire who may suffer from the vampire's weaknesses, sensitivity to sunlight and silver, but few of the strengths. Some humans seek this level of vampirism to achieve eternal youth and enhanced beauty. Several devotees of the theatrical profession have been rumored to have partaken in this ritual over the years.
Huh. I thought vampirism was pretty much a yay or nay proposition.
Oh, no, no, Mr. Wainwright said. There are many subtle layers of vampirism, of power and ability. You see, there is so much for you to learn. It's so exciting for me to be here with you, for the journey from bloodthirsty neophyte to sophisticated veteran vampire.
Happy to oblige, I said, shrugging amiably. Although, technically, I've never been what you'd call bloodthirsty.
I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, dear, he said. But don't you see how lucky you are? Vampires are among the few beings who trace their history as they live it. You can see the past, present, and future. You know who your great-great-grandparents, great-grandparents, and grandparents are. As your children, or, in your case, nephews. Now, don't make that face, dear. As your nephews have children, and grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, you'll be able to watch them grow, and live, and die. Each generation, if you take care of yourself, for eternity.
Staggered by the depressing nature of that thought, I patted his hands.
But you can do that too, just on a smaller scale. I mean, everybody around here knows who their great-grandparents are. And you have your nephew. You've been able to watch him grow up and have children.
My nephew moved to Guatemala for mission work nearly 5 years ago, and I rarely hear from him. I don't see him having children if there is a just and loving God.
Mr. Wainwright shook his head fondly at the mention of Emery, his late sister's Bible-thumping, personality-free son.
And I don't know who my great-grandparents were, at least not any relatives in this area. My mother was from up north, upstate New York, and my father died when I was very young. I'm afraid their union wasn't a very happy one, and she didn't keep many of his things. He rarely spoke to her about his family, and it seemed to upset her to talk about him. It might have been nice to have relatives, but from what I can see, it's sort of a genetic crapshoot. You're not likely to end up related to people you like.
Case in point, my Grandma Ruthie. But then you have wonderful chromosomal coincidences like my Aunt Jetty and my dad. He smiled. How about I start clearing through these boxes and you get back to the internet orders?
Wonderful, he said. And Jane, dear.
Don't throw anything away without showing it to you first, I repeated. How was I supposed to know that was spirit writing? It looked like a bunch of doodles on a cocktail napkin.
By the time Mr. Wainwright brought me an ancient Limoges teacup filled with microwaved pig's blood, I was covered in a fine layer of dust, but had cleared away most of the stock into keep, throw away, and burn on consecrated ground piles.
Thanks, I said, accepting the cup with a grateful, non-beating heart.
There's a young man asking for you up front, Jane, he said as I sipped. I think he's one of your kind. He looks vaguely familiar, but I can't quite place him.
Did he mention working for the council? I asked. Things tend to go badly for me when they drop by for a visit.
I doubt it, Mr. Wainwright said. He's wearing a T-shirt that says, One tequila, two tequila, three tequila floor. I don't think I've ever seen a vampire in a novelty T-shirt before. Extraordinary, really.
That could only be one vampire. Richard Cheney, whom I delight in calling Dick, is an old friend of Gabriel's, about 150 years old. Buddies from the cradle, they split over a gambling debt in their early 20s. Dick was turned 11 years later, also over a gambling debt. Do you see a pattern here? Dick is the local center for not quite legitimate commerce. If you want something, just ask Dick. But don't ask where, how, or which international laws he broke while procuring it. Also, you'll want to pay in cash. It wasn't as difficult as I expected to blend my one living friend into my new undead circle. Dick and Zeb got along famously. As Dick put it, Zeb grows on you like a stray, spazzy puppy that followed you home. And Zeb and Gabriel built a friendship on the shared experience of saving my ass from Missy, Dick's murderous ex. Even better, Zeb had somehow formed a bridge between Gabriel and Dick, former childhood friends who had turned eternal life into a prolonged male pissing contest. Thanks to the time they'd spent with Zeb, Gabriel and Dick had declared something of a ceasefire. And while they certainly weren't going to be getting matching tattoos anytime soon, at least Dick had stopped leaving silver shavings on Gabriel's furniture. If I was the best maid, then Dick could be considered Zeb's man of honor. Dick secured his spot in the wedding party after spending several bonding-filled weeks on Zeb's couch after his trailer blew up. Gabriel might have been promoted above groomsman had he been in town more often lately, and not made fun of Zeb's extensive G.I. Joe collection. Whether it's because he genuinely enjoys my company or enjoys irritating Gabriel, Dick and I had spent a lot of time together since I was turned. He became a regular visitor at River Oaks. In fact, he stayed on my couch for a few days after he wore out his welcome at Zeb's. Using his secret vampire wiles, Gabriel anonymously set Dick up at a nearby apartment because of Dick's tendency to make comments such as the following.
"Ah, the lovely Jane. I've always said you were a dirty girl,"
he said, swiping at the dust on my cheek. Dick could be considered attractive if you considered laughing, sea-green eyes, razor-sharp cheekbones, and full pouting lips permanently twisted into a mocking yet somehow seductive smirk attractive. Combine that with the constant barrage of sassy banter, and you got a you'll-regret-me-in-the-morning charisma that had almost every female who crossed his path melting into little puddles of giggly goo at his feet. I was a rare exception, and, as Dick often reminded me, his only strictly platonic friend who also happened to have breasts. I had a soft spot for Dick Cheney. Technically, it was my fault that his trailer had been torched by Missy in an attempt to frame me for his murder. And in between the disturbing innuendos, there was normally a nugget of likability. Buried deep. Deep down. "Wow. You are truly the master of the single entendre," I rolled my eyes. "Do your lines work on anybody, ever?"
"I just wanted to check on you, Stretch,"
he said, patting my head, a gesture that he knew I hated.
"Haven't seen you in a few days. I worry when I'm not called to save your cute little hind end at least once a week."
"I don't have a cute little hind end," I groused.
"I know. It's more medium to large, but I was trying to be kind,"
he replied, dodging the pocket guide to poltergeist activity I chucked at him.
"Keep that up and I'll go outside, take that rusty bucket you call a car and drive it into a quarry. It would be a mercy killing."
I squealed. "She's here?" I ran outside to find my old Ford station wagon, Big Bertha, parked in front of the store. Dick had used some of his not-quite-legal connections to barter for spare parts and repairs that I could not afford on a part-time shopgirl's salary. I just had to tutor some wear-skunk mechanics kids in English for the next semester.
"She's beautiful," I sighed, rubbing a loving hand over the dimpled hood. "It looks exactly the same," Dick said. "Pathetic. It probably cost you as much in repairs as it would to put a down payment on a decent car that doesn't smoke when you turn the ignition."
Big Bertha was my first car, my first love. Aunt Jetty taught me how to drive in this car. I'm just not ready to give her up yet. Dick smiled, an indulgent patriarch tolerating my whims.
"I figured, which is why I had Billy make some modifications."
My hands froze mid-stroke on Bertha's hood. "Dick, what did you do to my car?" He grinned.
"Well, let's just say Billy had some ideas for how to make Big Bertha a little more vamp-friendly. Tinted windows, SPF 500, thank you very much. Side curtain sun shields you can pull down in an emergency. Emergency sun protection packs tacked under the front seat.
a little refrigerated cooler for traveling with blood. It's cooled through the AC. And the pièce de résistance? He opened the back hatch. There was a coffin-sized door in the floor of the rear compartment. An emergency hidey hole. This is great, I said. This is just... wow. He shook his head. Would it be rude of me to question this sudden burst of generosity?
Well, Dick stretched a companionable arm around my shoulders and offered what I'm sure he thought was a guileless smile. You could put in a good word with your friend Andrea.
This was the thousandth or so anvil-sized hint Dick had dropped on me to hook him up with my blood surrogate friend. Most vampires are interested in Andrea Byrne's delicately flavored, extremely rare AB-negative blood. But Dick was far more interested in the fact that Andrea is also coolly, elegantly, irritatingly gorgeous. The two of them had a strange chemistry, like ammonia and bleach. Dick and Andrea moved in very different vampire circles. Most of Andrea's undead clients had houses without wheels. In a deliciously karmic development, Andrea didn't want much to do with Dick, not because she was a snob, but because he reminded her so much of Matthias Norton, a vampire college professor who had seduced her, introduced her to life as a blood surrogate, and dumped her like a bad habit. Smooth, effortless charm just pissed her off. I think being turned down by a woman for the first time in his long, long life fried something in Dick's brain because he'd been obsessed since meeting her. Oh, you're pure evil. I led him back into the store. You almost had me for a second there, pretending to be all sweet and vulnerable. Did you script this conversation out in your head before you came in here? Is this your special vampire power? Flirty manipulation? Dick made a deep, distressed noise and covered it with a cough.
Obviously not. Why won't she go out with me?
She knows your type, I said. She's painfully familiar with your type, Mr. Love 'em, bite 'em, and leave 'em.
That seems fair, he said dejectedly. Could you talk to her?
No, I said, firmly enunciating each word very carefully. I'm her friend, not her pimp. Put your big boy pants on and deal with this yourself. Maybe you could ask her to Zeb and Jolene's wedding.
He chuckled. Speaking of the gormless wonder, I got this in the mail today.
He took a cornflower blue envelope out of his back pocket and slid it across the counter.
Wow.
I marveled at the Lavelle McLean wedding invitation. I'd been trimmed from the invite list when Zeb and Jolene realized I was honor-bound to attend most of the wedding events anyway, so we didn't need to bring engraved stationery into the deal. I'd heard about them, but there are no words. Jolene and Zeb were having a Titanic-themed wedding. Personally, I think centering your nuptials around one of history's greatest maritime disasters is kind of creepy. But Jolene has a serious Kate and Leo complex. I guess I shouldn't judge. When I was a little girl, I dreamed I would get married in an ancient English castle and ride away in a horse-drawn carriage, and my sister would be tied up in the dungeon. Of course, I also thought I'd be marrying Mark Paul Gosselaar from Saved by the Bell, and we can all see how that turned out. Jolene's theme was a mix of the morbidly historical and old Hollywood glamour. Her wedding ensemble consisted of a rhinestone copy of The Heart of the Ocean and a slightly too flattering-to-be-true-to-period costume. Zeb just barely managed to talk her out of having decorative life preservers made up with their names and wedding date. She was, however, using a model of the Titanic to serve chips and salsa. The boat was split in two, the salsa on one side and the chips in the other. She ordered this monstrosity online, along with her wedding ensemble and the invitations with an embossed iceberg on the cover and the words, "Struck by Love." If you looked closely enough at the crags and the pressed relief iceberg, you could make out Jolene and Zeb's initials. Some people should not be allowed access to the Internet. "What exactly are the rules for bringing dates to werewolf weddings?" I asked. I didn't get an invitation per se, so I can't exactly send back a response card with a plus one. Then again, Gabriel's a groomsman, so I assume they know he's coming. You, on the other hand, got an invitation, but it's addressed to you alone. Are you allowed a plus one?
I haven't been to a wedding in about
90 years, Dick admitted. I'm still trying to figure out what those little pieces of tissue between the envelopes are for.
Zeb said you guys are doing some sort of manly bowling drinking bonding thing this weekend. Do I have to give you the allow my friend to be hurt by one of your less than reputable acquaintances and you'll wake up with my foot lodged in your nether region speech?
No,
he said, grinning broadly. Good, because the title gives away the ending. Dick muttered. See if I help you escape certain death again.
Well, do you have any other homicidal ex-girlfriends who might try to frame me for murder?
He made a rude hand motion I choose not to describe here. It was enough to bring Mr. Wainwright out from the shelves to scold Dick for his lack of chivalry.
In my day, gentlemen didn't make gestures like that at ladies, he said, drawing himself to his full height, all 5 feet and 6 inches of him.
Osteoporosis had not been kind. Dick grinned lazily, unashamed.
Once you spend more time with her, Gilbert, you'll understand.
Mr. Wainwright's eyes narrowed, staring.
Do I know you?
Yes,
Dick said. He winked at me.
See you later, Stretch.
Do you know him? I asked after Dick left. He shook his head.
I have no idea. I have a much better memory for books than for people.
You're probably better off, I assured him.
I couldn't help but overhear you talking about Zeb's upcoming nuptials, Jane. I think I have a book that might help you.
He held up a softcover volume titled Mating Rituals and Love Customs of the Were. I opened to a section titled Human-Werewolf Relations, and read aloud. The best way for a suitor to win over a female werewolf's father is to present him with a fresh carcass. The larger the game, the more impressive the suit. Deer and elk make a bold statement. Squirrels and rabbits will get you laughed out of the pack. I kissed the top of his balding pate. A book for every problem. I love you, Mr. Wainwright. He flushed with pleasure, squeezing my hands.
The feeling is mutual, dear.
Chapter 3. Because of their natural animalistic leanings, were creatures are more connected to their sexual instincts than the average human. Because premarital relations are frowned upon in the were community, were honeymoons generally last 3 or 4 more times as long as human honeymoons. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. Other than a new career, new hours, new diet, new friends, and a slightly unhealthy sire-child relationship, not much had changed in the months since I'd been turned. No, wait. I was going broke. That was new. My part-time paychecks weren't enough to fund my extravagant lifestyle. Thanks to the wonders of vampirism, I'd been able to cut out little extras such as food and medical insurance. But the taxes on River Oaks were coming due soon. The water heater was making weird noises, and there was a suspicious and expensive-looking sag in my roof just over Aunt Jetty's old room. I had a 200-pound dog to feed and an expensive dental regimen to maintain. And the payment people at Visa were starting to ask questions. The financial juggling was becoming a little more than I could keep up with. Complicating matters was the delay in my Triumph settlement. Earlier that year, I'd fought Missy, the evil realtor, to the death after she'd framed me for a series of crimes, all in an effort to obtain River Oaks, or rather, the property River Oaks stood on. My sprawling old family farm was the keystone plot in a tacky, undead condo development she had planned. Frustrated by Aunt Jetty's refusal to sell, Missy had decided to use the World Council for the Equal Treatment of the Undead's laws governing vampire behavior to yank the property out from under me. So I didn't feel too bad about running her through with one of her own realty signs. In the vampire world, if you kill another vampire in battle, you get all of his or her stuff. And since Missy had spent years amassing property and swindling vampires out of their homes, that amounted to quite a bit of stuff. But after months of red tape and delays, I wasn't holding my breath for the council to fulfill its promise to fork over Missy's holdings anytime soon. Of course, holding my breath wouldn't really matter one way or the other. But
I hadn't told anyone about my financial woes, not even dearly departed Aunt Jetty. There was nothing I could do. I was stuck. I was too fond of Mr. Wainwright to leave specialty books. Even though I was basically an unglorified sales clerk with two advanced degrees, I'd gotten the distinct impression that Mr. Wainwright had come to depend on me. He was doing less and less at the shop, opening later, going to bed earlier in his little apartment over the store, and leaving me to close. I couldn't abandon him. If I told my parents I was having money problems, Mama would, well, I don't think she would insist I move back in with them now, but I'm sure my life, liberty, and pursuit of healthy boundaries would be infringed upon in some way. And while Gabriel had made repeated offers to help me out financially, that just wasn't relationship baggage I wanted. Most sire-child relationships are not as complicated as ours. Gabriel is dark and intense, obsessive to the point of being just this side of creepy. Some guys bring you flowers and candy. Others exact biblical revenge by pushing trees on top of the drunk hunter who fatally shot you. I'm more of a crunchy granola pacifist vampire, so I found this rather disturbing. Okay, it was a tiny bit hot, but mostly disturbing. I knew Gabriel was not evil. For that matter, neither was I. Vampires have the same capacity for good and evil that humans do. To be fair, people can lose some notions of etiquette when they're no longer answering to moral constraints of human society, and they thirst for human blood. The bottom line is that if you had evil leanings in your life, you're probably going to embrace them wholeheartedly when you're undead. If you were a decent person, say a former librarian who loves America and puppies, you're probably going to be an upstanding, almost vegetarian vampire. It took Gabriel and me weeks to work through the weird feelings that followed his murdering Bud McElroy. As a human, I'd never been in love. I'd been in deep, abiding like with several of my boyfriends, but I'd never had that feeling that, wow, this is a person I could spend the rest of my life with feeling. And even though Gabriel was one of the few people I could spend the rest of my long, long life with, I couldn't think of being with him as a permanent situation. He'd saved me. He'd killed for me. But I couldn't accept that someone like him could be interested in me. Gabriel was everything I was not, sophisticated and complicated and able to color-coordinate a room like you wouldn't believe. I craved him with a bone-deep lust I'd once reserved exclusively for Godiva truffles. I was fixated. Not just in the physical sense, though that was an obvious and occasionally distracting bonus, but with what he thought, how he saw the world, how he saw me. It was addictive to see myself reflected in his liquid silver eyes as strong, beautiful, intelligent, interesting, though slightly exasperating. Even when we were together, all I could think about was the next time we could be together. I needed order. I needed constancy. But being with Gabriel was like standing in the center of a swirling eddy, the dark water surrounding you, dizzying, powerful, and beautiful. But all the while, you can't help but feel those churning walls closing in, threatening to crash in on you and crush you under their weight. I couldn't seem to find my footing in this relationship. It didn't help that Gabriel kept leaving town on business trips like this current one, the third excursion in as many months. Now that he wasn't keeping constant keep Jane alive and out of trouble vigils, Gabriel was spending some time catching up with his various business interests. He was the proprietor of three radio stations in the southeast, plus a hotel in Atlanta, a seafood restaurant in New Orleans, and a mini golf course in Biloxi. And those were just the ventures in this country. I know it sounds like Tony Soprano's investment portfolio, but to be fair, he had more than 100 years to diversify. Older vampires are heavily invested in human real estate, medical research, music, publishing, and media. It's what has helped maintain our cover for 2 millennia. It's not a conspiracy or anything. We're just trying to keep you people from setting us on fire in our sleep. If we controlled everything, do you really think the Lifetime Network would have had a vampire detective show? So Gabriel floated in and out of my world, letting me think I could handle life without him, only to show up after a few weeks and make me crazy all over again. I was frequently left to wallow and wonder where he was and what he wasn't telling me. I excelled at wallowing and wondering. If I called, it went to his voicemail. If he called, it was always just before dawn as I was falling asleep and didn't have the mental capacity to ask him much. This, combined with a painfully active imagination, led to scenarios that would have done that Lifetime show very proud.
And, of course, he had to come home from his latest trip on a Tuesday night to find me wearing my housework sweats and a dirty bandana around my head. "Have we discussed the call first rule?" I asked when I opened the door, suppressing a giddy smile. Gabriel had been impossibly beautiful, even in the harsh neon lights of Shenanigans, that first night I met him. And now that I had sharp vampire vision, I could fully appreciate the leonine dreaminess that was my sire. There he stood, wearing his typical Johnny Cash full black, flowing dark locks curling at his collar, his full, soft lips quirked at my rude greeting, and a flicker of warmth reflected back at me in those clear gray eyes. Despite our general resilience, he looked tired. There was the slightest hint of shadows under his eyes, and even for a vampire, he looked pretty pale.
"Hello, Gabriel. It's lovely to see you,"
he responded in a feminine voice that frankly sounded nothing like me.
"I missed you terribly. How was Nashville?"
"Hello, Gabriel. It's lovely to see you," I parroted in an explicitly pleasant tone. "How was Nashville? Have we discussed the call first rule?"
"Can I come in?"
he asked, hefting a foam cooler with his hip. A girl couldn't help but appreciate the way those hips looked in black denim. I paused to give them the proper reverence. I opened the door wider, then stopped him with a hand to his chest. "Wait. You have that we-have-to-talk look on your face, which usually means I'm going to be accused of something."
"For once? No."
He advanced against my palm. I held him back. He pouted.
"This is getting heavy."
"You have super strength," I pointed out, grinning despite myself. "What's in the cooler?"
"A present."
He opened the top and proudly displayed a dozen pint-sized plastic envelopes of blood packed in dry ice. I cocked my head and studied him thoughtfully.
"The next time you go shopping for me, take Andrea."
He carried his burden into the kitchen where he carefully stored his repellent treasures in the empty vegetable crisper.
"This is prime Red Cross-grade human donation," he said. "Tested, screened, and cleared through a lab in the city."
"That's wonderful. But why did you bring it here?"
"Can't I do something nice?"
he asked, clearly offended. I stared at him. "You might have started with a card and maybe worked your way up to human blood."
"I worry about how you eat,"
he said as he sifted through the pathetic contents of my fridge.
"I want you to drink a pint of this every day."
"I've told you that it makes me uncomfortable when you blur that daddy-boyfriend line, right?" I said. He held up half-empty bottles of Hershey's syrup and Bailey's Irish cream. "That's just for flavor."
"I'm afraid that you're becoming too accustomed to drinking synthetic blood, Jane," he said. "It's only a recent development, and production could stop with the turn of the political tide. And then where will you be?"
"On eBay, looking for remainders?" I guessed.
"What if you're too far away from a store to get a supply? What if the supply is tainted? You need to become more comfortable drinking human blood."